I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. If you're looking to experience a spectacular gun battle, maybe shed a tear, or be terrified, tantalized, and tickled all in one weekend, get out of the real world and into a theater. Today, the film critics grace us once again to review and recommend the latest independent, foreign, and documentary movies making waves around Metro KC. They'll cover two tales of love and loss set around the Second World War. One young daytime vampire, a soul-crushing monster smashing through South Korea, and some Amazonian intrigue based on an incredible true story. There's a little something for everyone on Up to Date after this hour's news. Today, independent films about an unbelievable range of topics. We'll rate one movie about the youngest majors champion in the history of golf, another about an urban vampire in New York City, and still others about the great impressionist Cezanne and great giant lizards and robots, all kinds of crazy stuff. That's Variety for you. Our critics today, KCUR's Steve Walker. Steve.
Hey, good morning.
Bob Butler reviews movies for the Kansas City Star. You can read them also online every week at butlercinemascene.com. Bob, how are you?
Great. Hello, everybody.
Cindy Haynes is away again, so Beck Ireland is here. She's co-founder of the movie review site The Rest is Advertising, and she writes for kcactive.com. Beck, good morning to you.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
At the top here, we should mention the death of Academy Award-winning director Jonathan Demme, the man behind The Silence of the Lambs, Philadelphia, and The Manchurian Candidate. What kind of impact did Denny have, guys?
Well, Demme started doing kind of drive-in movies like Caged Heat.
Roger Corman,
who worked for Roger Corman. He then went on in the 80s. He kind of bumped up a notch and did some really great independent films like Something Wild, which blew me away.
It's one of my favorites.
And from that point on, it's with Jeff Daniels and Melanie Griffith, Ray Liotta's first film. I followed him religiously after Something Wild because it was so crazy. Married to the Mob was really well done comedy.
Melvin and Howard.
And Stop Making Sense, which was the Talking Heads movie, is considered one of the best concert movies ever made.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting. He had big studio hits.
Right.
But with the exception of The Silence of the Lamb, I think of him as totally an independent filmmaker.
Me too.
A little guy who worked on a modest budgets, but really put his heart into it.
Yeah, he definitely has the independent flavor. He's also a great music lover, and he's brought some great music, Stop Making Sense. And then even in Something Wild, he introduced Sister Carol to the world.
Right. He did all those Neil Young music documentaries.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
What was he especially good at?
Wow.
Little humanist movies about people whose lives you might consider to be inconsequential, but he made them matter.
We're going to do a lot of movies like that today, actually. But someone said on the radio the other day at NPR, he didn't have a style per se. You couldn't see a 30-second clip and go, oh, that's Demme, like you could a Scorsese or a De Palma or something.
Right. I do credit him, though, with sort of formulating the sort of charming, evil genius, you know. He had Hannibal Lecter, and that was sort of the start of everything that we see on TV so much now Criminal Minds and all.
Very
that.
Very effective movie.
Yes.
Iconic film, of course.
Why did that film, The Silence of the Lambs, hit so hard? What was it about that film that really got people?
I just think it was Hopkins' performance,
Foster's It was great acting in a form in a style of movie that most people consider to be exploitation.
And it was a relationship. They were able to connect in a way.
The worst marriage ever.
Exactly. it was about connecting with those two, and you don't usually get that in that kind of movie. Yeah.
And it was just effectively creepy and scary, especially when she's got those night vision goggles on. Brilliant piece of filmmaking.
And very quotable.
Yeah, absolutely.
So many lines have made it into the popular lexicon.
Okay, well, let's move on to some films that are now out on area screens here. Let's go to Graduation, Steve Walker. It's in modern-day Romania, where corruption and morally suspect favors are the norm. A father strives to ensure that his daughter aces her pre-college exams.
Right, and this is from Romanian director Cristian Mungiu, who won the Palme d'Or 10 years ago for his devastating film about a black market abortion called 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. Mm-hmm. Don't know if you remember that film.
Vaguely.
So his films continue to be about Romania's, the repercussions of their dictator, Ceausescu, still resonates in their country where everyone's on the take. There's and the guy who wants his daughter to ace her exam so she can get out of their little town is a doctor and probably the town doctor, and even he is very persuadable because he says about his daughter, all that matters is the result. And he compromises her as well. I won't spoil it. But
the interesting thing about this is that the doctor and his wife had left Romania under the communist regime, came back when Ceausescu fell, thinking a brave new world is upon us, only to find that a bureaucracy took over that requires the same sort of day-in, day-out cheating and black market just to survive. It's about a country where just to survive, you got to break the law.
I do think it's important to point out, though, that this is the one time in his professional life that he's being dishonest. He's a doctor who's known for not taking bribes from people, but he uses this influence for this one exception for his daughter.
But, well, I mean, I don't remember that detail.
In his personal life,
a couple of times they were like, could you take care of my nephew who's got this if I do this for you? And then he compromises his daughter. It's like he has no redeeming qualities anymore. But still, he's a nice guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's definitely doing out of good intentions.
And what's interesting, it's set in Kajul, K-J-U-L. And from the looks of it on screen, it looks like just a decrepit little village out in the middle of nowhere. It's the second largest city in Romania, which was really fascinating to me.
Well, I think it's great that he can sustain. He did it in his previous film, and in this film, he sustains this intensity where there are threats that aren't even really defined. Windows get broken, his car is vandalized.
Right.
It's never really explained, but this is just a very threatening place to live.
It's a mood of tenseness for sure. It's a really nice film. Really,
the film was
it.
Graduation. I was going to say, do you recommend it?
Oh yes,
yeah,
very much.
Oh, three thumbs up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right out of the gate for Graduation. Okay, the story set in modern day Romania,
and it's at the Tivoli. It's the only place it's playing. Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to a film, The Transfiguration. Becca, this is a fresh take on an old story: the urban vampire as lived by an orphaned African American teenage boy in New York City.
This is a really interesting film. It's a horror film, but it's you say vampire, but he's not really a vampire, as you can tell from the title of the movie. He's trying to become a vampire, and this is a little boy suffering from PTSD, living in a really bad neighborhood. He's being terrorized by a local gang, and he's being raised by his brother, who is an Iraq vet. So there's all these instances in which PTSD plays a part in this movie.
Interesting observation.
And he is obsessed with vampire movies and is trying to become a vampire. So really, it's a horror movie about horror movies and how we watch movies. So I think this can lead into the clip where the boy meets this other orphan girl who's living. She's the only white girl in his projects, and they have a very interesting discussion about vampire movies.
This is from The Transfiguration.
It's just, I bet the vampires in Twilight aren't very realistic.
There's no such thing as a realistic vampire.
There is. I mean, more realistic. I mean, vampires don't twinkle.
Okay, so what are vampires like?
Well, I think it starts with drinking blood. Like you have a need to. It's like when you have a cut on your finger when you're a little kid and you're sucking on it. But eventually that's not good enough. So you switch to animals and stuff like that, and then you know people. And you change a lot after the first person you kill. And you change a lot more after one after another. But I think when you first start out being a vampire, all the stuff you see in the movies doesn't really matter. Like, you can go out in the sun and you can eat garlic, and I don't even think the church stuff is even true. Like, maybe to religious vampires, you know? And I don't think you get bit. I think it's like a disease you get.
Wow. Which book is this?
It's not a book. It's just how I think it is.
Why is he so interested in becoming a vampire?
I think it's sort of the nature of vampires in movies as a metaphor for something otherworldly and powerful. Mm-hmm. He's picked on. He's called freak by the kids in the neighborhood, mm-hmm. you know, partly because of what he's doing to try to become a vampire, but also because of his situation. He's very small. Mm. He's a very small 14-year-old boy, and he has no power. His greatest wish is to be this all-powerful vampire, just to transform into something, you know, that has power.
This young actor, his name's Eric Ruffin. He's amazing in it. And what's so funny is that his older brother does never seen off the couch. He's watching movies the whole time, including at one point The Piano, which I found, mm-hmm. I was like, really? He's watching The Piano? That's interesting.
Yeah.
It's a very lovely film, and it's the first film from this director, Michael O'Shea, who's not a young man. So I was just curious.
He graduated from film school in the 90s and was right. He worked fixing computers and is a bouncer.
Oh.
He's been writing movies, scripts this whole time.
Oh.
And this is the first one that he was able to get produced, and he directed it himself. Mm-hmm. And this actually premiered at Cannes last year,
mm-hmm.
which
is very
unusual for an American film, especially an American sort of horror film.
Right.
His girlfriend, though, is the producer Susan Lieber, who did Obvious Child and Learning to Drive. Margin Call. She's worked with a lot of famous directors, and she apparently helped him with a lot of the creative direction.
So this film's pretty good, too, it sounds like.
It is, I think so. Bob,
I haven't seen it.
Okay, yeah, I think it's also on my three to see.
Yeah, it's definitely. I mean, it can make you a little queasy, you know, but especially for horror fans, this is like
the
holy grail. Yeah, because there's so much talk about the different vampire movies. So.
And queasy because...
It's bloody.
Oh, it's bloody.
There's blood. Yeah, he's trying to be a vampire, and all that entails.
He's got the date once a month around the 15th, like your water bell, Kresge.
Yeah,
he has to feed.
Yeah, he feeds, and then he's waiting to be transformed.
Okay, I'm getting a clearer picture here. Again, that's the transfiguration here. Okay, moving on as we review the latest independent films now showing here in Kansas City. Bob Butler, let's talk about a film, After the Storm. It's about a divorced novelist with writer's block and a gambling problem who is attempting to reconnect with his son and ex-wife.
This one crept up on me. You've got a protagonist who is, to say the least, deeply flawed. 40-year-old man. His wife has divorced him. He... used to be a promising novelist. Now he works as a private eye and takes advantage of that fact to spy on his ex-wife. He's a gambler. He's in debt. He's behind in his child support. In other words, he sounds like a total creep. And at the end of the movie, I ended up really loving this guy. The actor's name is Hiroshi Abe, and the film was made by Hirokazu Koreeda, who made one of my favorite films of last year, Our Little Sister. It's about this guy, his family, his attempts to connect with them. What I love about the film is that it's gentle, it's sweet, mm-hmm. it's sad, and it has a real. It's not blind to human failure, but it accepts it. It's the way we are.
I think it's bittersweet for sure, rather than sweet. And all of his other films, including Still Walking and Nobody Knows, he has given substantial roles to elderly people, elderly actors. And so it is about the passages of life and what is expected of you at various points.
His mother, the character's mother, is a major figure here. And she knows she's old. She knows she hasn't got that much longer. And she just wants to set things straight with her family before it's all over.
Kieran Kiki is Yoshiko, the mother, I think steals the movie.
Yeah, she's
really
fun.
A delight in every scene that she's in.
You know, it's funny. Sometimes you go see a Japanese movie and there's a kind of formality to Japanese life that Americans don't really relate to. This could have been made as an American film because the family dynamic is so relaxed. The people, they joke with each other. They, you know, are ironic with each other. Felt like a real family you could identify with, not this sort of stiff, formal bow from the waist type of life.
I agree. I think one of the delightful things about Kurita's filmmaking is he shows people eating. There are films in which people don't eat and then films in which people eat. These people eat. It's always around the table. It's always just this. And so you get a slice of this Japanese life.
Right.
Too, with the food, but then it also shows their dynamics.
And other people, the other interesting point is that other people who live in that apartment complex with his mother are also a lot of older people, a lot of adult children who've come back to take care of them. So it just kind of shows a respect, again, for elderly people.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, it's in Japanese, so no clip for this one. No but clip. Again, you guys like this
Terrific.
One.
Terrific.
Yeah,
like.
Yep. Very good movie. Mm-hmm.
Very good movie. I'm going to put a little star right there next to that one for my weekend viewing here. Okay, one film that's got a little bit of a buzz attached to it, Bob Butler. It's The Lost City of Z, the true story of the British adventurer who heads up the Amazon for the purpose of making contact with indigenous people who are yet to be discovered. And the author of this book will be on our show here in the next
oh,
week
really?
Or two. I can't.
Oh, nice.
He was on for Lost City of Z. He's got a new book out, and we'll have him on for that as well here.
Bob. Well, this being a British movie, you should refer to it as The Lost City of Zed, which is how they...
Okay.
Thank you for bringing that up.
Okay. What we've got here, this is a more or less true story based on the last turn of the century adventures of a British officer named Percy Fawcett, played by Charlie Hunnam, who is about as far away from his Sons of Anarchy persona as you can get. He's... As someone says, he had an unfortunate choice of ancestors, and that has kept him from advancing in, of course, class-conscious England. But he gets a chance to do something remarkable. Bolivia and Brazil are having a border dispute. No one knows where the border is, and he is sent by the British government to map the border deep in the Amazon. And basically, it's him and another guy who's played by, believe it or not, Robert Pattinson of Twilight fame with a full beard and almost unrecognizable. Now, the film alternates. It goes through three expeditions this guy does over 20-some years. The first one is wildly successful. The second one ends in near disaster. And the third one, I won't even tell you what happens with that. James Gray, who made this, has made lots of little intimate movies about ethnic communities like Little Odessa and The Yards. He's working on a David Lean scale here, practically. I don't think he gets the balance entirely right. Even with David Lean movies like Lawrence of Arabia, sometimes the human story gets buried in the visual splendor. But I think this is a really interesting movie, and the jungle sequences are you actually feel like you should be swatting mosquitoes. They're so visceral.
Well done. Yeah.
I have to disagree. I really didn't like this movie.
Really?
I felt like the jungle trips were sort of one jungle movie trope after another. Native spears, panther. The one thing that I did find interesting was Angus McFadyen as explorer James Murray. I thought that was a great story about sort of the hubris of these explorers at the time. He was on an expedition with Shackleton to the South Pole, so he, you know, he's
apparently he worked better in cold climates.
Exactly, he did not do so well. So,
in the jungle.
So I thought that was a really great portrayal. But for me, the interesting part was Sienna Miller as Fawcett's wife. She's actually the person who goes to the archives and finds this document describing this lost city. We don't get any of that, though. We don't get her research. We don't get sort of her partnership with him.
Right.
At all, yeah.
And you would have liked to have seen that?
I would have, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's very important to his story, to his drive.
Well, she allowed him to do that. She raised the family. She was almost a proto-feminist before her time.
Exactly. So I feel like what's missing in the movie is sort of Fawcett's drive of what brings him back to the jungle over and over again. And it's this lost city and trying to prove that, you know, native civilizations were just as advanced at a time or even more advanced at a time than European.
I really liked the Fawcett characters railing against the church for calling them savages, and the church maintained this air of superiority over these horrible, savage, primitive people. And he said, no, they're people.
Yeah,
they have their own worlds. They have their own lives, families.
Yeah, it's actually at the Royal Geographic Society, and the evidence he brings back are this pottery shards that he's found, and they end up like yelling at him, just, you know, pots and pans, because they think that this is just, you know, domestic stuff. These savages can't actually do, you know, math or, you know, have created the civilization. So
the irony, of course, is that 100 years after his last expedition, they recently found a lost city, a lost civilization in the Amazon. So he was on the right track.
And Machu Picchu was discovered right around the same time Fawcett was over there.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, Beck Ireland's not so crazy about this film. Bob Butler seemed to like it.
I'm modestly enthusiastic.
Steve? It's okay. Yeah. Do we want to hear a clip?
I'm not sensing a lot of enthusiasm.
It's okay.
Here.
I mean, it's fine. I finished
it's
it.
It's fine.
I finished
okay,
it.
All right. Okay.
It's not my least favorite
in
movie.
This clip.
He finished it because it's almost 3 hours long.
Yeah.
Too.
Is that
it is.
Right?
It,
yes.
That's another David Lean-ish moment there. The clip is about a member of the Royal Geographic Society giving Fawcett his instructions for this first trip to the Amazon.
This is from the Lost City of Z.
There is now considerable argument between Bolivia and Brazil as to what constitutes their border. So fantastically high is the price of rubber that war could arise. Do you follow?
I do, sir. Mm-hmm. Although I'm not sure what this has to do with me.
I'm getting to that. Neither country will accept mapping done by the other, so they've requested us to act as referee. Mm.
As you completed your mapping here with distinction, you came under our consideration.
I see. Sirs, may I speak candidly?
Please.
My survey work was long ago. To be quite honest, I was rather hoping for a position where I might see a fair bit of action.
Major, this is far more than just survey work. This is exploration in the jungle. The environment's brutally difficult.
That's from The Lost City of Z, and sort of middling reviews for that one here, right?
Yes.
Even though it's gotten a little bit of buzz attached to it. Okay, let's take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some other really interesting films. A film about Cezanne. I'll be at that one this weekend. Their Finest, Steve Walker, is raving about it. And Tommy's Honor, Colossal, and several others as well. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. It's a Friday. We're talking good films, lots of good films, actually, this weekend with KCUR Steve Walker, Bob Butler, who reviews movies for The Star, and Beck Ireland. She's co-founder of the movie review site, The Rest is Advertising. We're going through a bunch of good films here. And there's one here that has had me intrigued just because I enjoy his art as much as I do, Cezanne and I. It's about how the egos of two artists, painter Paul Cezanne and writer Emile Zola, complicated their lifelong friendship just because of their egos, Steve Walker.
Well, their egos, and then what director Daniel Thompson does so well is, even though we're following them from boyhood, where they were friends, to their teens, to their 50s, I believe, and back and forth, the artistic temperament that some writers, we all know at this table, some artists, present company excluded completely. The artistic temperament of an equal mix, self-doubt and self-importance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think both of these characters are back and forth with that all the time.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's really hard to imagine Cezanne as like a frustrated unknown. Mm-hmm. But there he was, you know, and I think that's what this movie does to show.
I think he must have been in his late 50s when he finally was quote-unquote discovered.
But there he was in his 20s, seen at pubs with Renoir, Picasso, Manet, right?
Right. He's being overshadowed by all the impressionists.
Oh, yeah, who are becoming famous quicker. So he's like, oh, I'm horrible. I'll never amount to anything. Well, my work doesn't matter.
You've got Zola, who in the late 1860s was a best-selling author. Huge. And here's his friend from childhood who is struggling to find a painting style. And, okay, two best friends. One is incredibly successful. The other isn't. What could go wrong with that equation? What I love about the movie, in the end, you realize that these two people probably know each other better than anyone else on Earth.
Right.
And every time they meet, there's some bickering. There's a little bit of backstabbing.
Yeah.
And yet they finally settle down to this appreciation of this, of each other, and a friendship that has lasted when lots of life is just, you know, in and out.
Yeah.
This is a constant in their existence.
And I think we need to talk about the friction coming from that they're both from very different classes in France at this time. You know, Zola came from a very poor background. His father had died. His mom was raising him, you know, and Cezanne, you know, who was, you know, sort of spitting on the bourgeoisie at the time, you know, wanted to live the poor artist's life.
You know, I always wonder about films like this because I'm really interested in it because I enjoy Cézanne as much as I do. And there's those new works at the Nelson Atkins from the Henry Block collection that are so wonderful. I always wonder, I have a largely blank slate in my mind when it comes to Paul Cézanne. So I wonder how true to life is this film? How accurate is it? Because if it's misleading, it's going to redirect my feelings about Cézanne the rest of my life inaccurately.
I wouldn't overthink it.
Really? I'm going to, though.
But I appreciate that.
I'm a journalist. I want the real stuff.
Was Mike Leigh's movie about Turner accurate? It was sure entertaining. I don't know how absolutely 100% accurate it was.
But these things put an image of these people in your mind forever.
But sometimes accuracy doesn't make for good movie watching.
Oh, really? That's a new concept. That's why I'm asking the question.
Well, Danielle Thompson, the director, is an art collector herself, and the movie is beautifully shot. There's the opening credits especially are just these intense, crisp close-ups of paint on a palette that I just loved.
Cinematographer Jean-Marie Jeju is the one who worked on it, and he definitely is taking inspiration from the Impressionists and from Cézanne.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's some of these landscapes. There's that one mountain that Cézanne painted over and over and over again. In fact, I think we've got one of those at the Nelson now. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene of him painting in front of that mountain, and you actually can feel the atmosphere the way that he interpreted through his brush. It's really
and he never gave up, which is kind of inspirational in its way.
Yeah, and there's interesting side stories to the painting and the evolution of the painting that was happening at the time, particularly with Tanguy, who was making the colors for them. When he makes the actual tube of color that they can take to do their plein air paintings, there's really interesting details like that.
Great. Yeah. Well, I'll go see it, but just for the record, my concerns have not been satisfied.
Well, I've
thrown it out there and nothing really was responded to.
Take good notes and go home and Google it.
And shut up. Yeah, okay. Shut up and enjoy the film. I get where you're coming from. Okay, the next film on our list here is Free Fire, Bob Butler. It's about an abandoned factory in Boston. Is the Boston setting of an hour-long shootout between the buyers and sellers in an international arms deal.
Yeah, this is like taking a shower in testosterone and stupidity.
I haven't recovered yet.
It was made by a guy named Ben Wheatley, who has a couple of pretty good films to his credit, one called Kill List. What you get here is sort of Tarantino light. The inspiration here seems to be Reservoir Dogs and maybe The Hateful Eight. You get a dozen...
No, thank you.
A dozen dumb macho guys
Brie Larson being held kidnapped again.
In an enclosed space with a van full of illegal weapons, a briefcase full of money, and what could go wrong? Well, there's miscommunication. The IRA, this is set in the 70s. The guys from the IRA are there to buy weapons. Charlton Copley plays a Rhodesian arms dealer who is... Boy, what can I say? This is a case where Charlton Copley's overacting works. He's just a macho idiot. And it starts out with a great deal of manly insults, which I found to be amusing. The second half of the movie is all shooting, but these guys are such bad shots that
they have to keep shooting.
They have to keep shooting.
Yeah.
And everyone gets more and more holes in them.
Yeah, it just gets to a ridiculous point where they shouldn't even be functioning anymore.
It's executive produced by, hold on to your hat, Martin Scorsese.
Yeah. Oh, is that right?
Which really surprised me more after I saw it.
Yeah.
Than while I was watching it.
It's moderately entertaining, but it wears out its welcome.
Yeah, it's an hour long.
Yeah, it could have been about something, but it wasn't.
No, not really.
I get the picture here. What is the clip we have here?
Well, what we've got here is Charlton Copley as the Rhodesian gun dealer, and he's sort of setting the groundwork for this transaction.
Should we apologize for the clip?
There's no language. Okay. There's some shooting, so trigger warning.
From Free Fire.
I think we got off on a little bit of a bad footing there, eh? I think what we need to do is just start afresh. So I'm going to be the gentleman in this relationship, and I'm going to chuck in a free box of lube because she likes to run wet.
Whoa. Slow the roll for a minute. Public safety announcement. While the rifle's hot, I'm going to pull my pistol out. Nothing personal.
Knock yourself out, Sparky. Okay, just try not to hit any of the metalwork because I don't want to get any of those bling burns on my new suit.
Sorry, what was that?
This is from Savile.
I don't know about you guys, but I for one think Vern's merchandise is a real gas.
My guess is you're whatever you're paid to be, pal.
Did you see what you did, yeah?
I think we get the idea.
Yeah, it's, that's
that was
idea.
A very well chosen clip. You yeah. Get it. Yeah.
Well, and it's like a play set in one living room. It's set in this one umbrella factory, mm-hmm. which is very picturesque and it's
just full
decrepit.
Of, full
way.
Of piles of dirt. And,
yeah.
I think
naked
the,
columns.
The one good thing you can say about it has great sound design, though. While you're in the theater, it.
Oh, yeah.
Coming from all over. You
and
know?
I love the soundtrack, too. This some 70s crap.
Yeah. yeah.
Okay, that film, again, Free Fire. Don't bother to go see it. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're talking with our film critics, Steve Walker, Bob Butler. Beck Ireland is here sitting in for Cindy Haynes today, who is away. Okay, maybe on a brighter note, a more positive note, Steve, you want to talk about the film Their Finest. This is about the crew of a British film crew in 1940, exemplifying the sentiment behind keep calm and carry on.
Well, and we know that as the big British thing that's on every mug that people bring back. In the 40s, the war had just sort of started. America hadn't been entrusted to join at mm-hmm. that point.
Pearl Harbor hadn't happened.
Right. But the British film industry said, we need to keep making movies. We need to make movies about the war and about soldiers and about the spirit of Britain and how we will come together and be united. And so this crew was making a film about Dunkirk, and it's got some various players that I really kind of loved. Gemma Arterton, who's terrific. She's a woman who thinks she's being hired to be a secretary. And they said, no, you're a script writer. You're going to help us with the script on this. You're going to write, as one man says to her, the slop. She's like, what do you mean? He said, any woman dialogue is the slop. That's what you're writing. Bill Nighy plays this vainglorious actor in his 60s who feels like he's at the end of his career.
He's wonderful as always.
Oh, yeah. Her husband, her boyfriend is a failed painter who's not very nice. And then when they decide to add an American to it, because otherwise Americans wouldn't go see it, Jake Lacy, who was in the last season of The Office,
right.
you would recognize his face. He mm-hmm. plays this bleach blonde American hunk who can't act his way out of a paper bag. And all that sounds overly funny. I just feel like it was rooted in more reality, and it was very interesting to watch all the people involved with this film treat her as they try to put her in her place, but she's more skilled than that and more determined than that.
One of the more interesting elements, I think, is that periodically throughout the film, you see clips from the film they're making. And it's an interesting, you'll see them in meetings talking about how to create this movie that will get the Americans interested in the war. Then to see the actual clips and the manipulation, how they work on your tear ducts, dramatically speaking. That was kind of clever, I thought.
Yeah, this director, Loni Scherfey, she was one of the founding members of the Dogma 95, mm-hmm. which had strict rules. There were Danish filmmakers, Lars von Trier was one of them, about how to make movies with sort of getting away from the studio. So true independent movies where actors wore their own clothes and the sounds had to all be coming from sources within the movie itself.
And there was no lighting
exactly.
except whatever light was
She's,
in the room.
I think the perfect director to do this movie about making movies mm-hmm. in such like an artificial way. And the practical effects that they had to use and things, it's all very interesting.
Steve, you really liked this film.
I really liked it. And I hadn't seen it until this past weekend. But I went Sunday afternoon. The Tivoli was pretty packed, actually. I think a lot of people are taking a venture to catch this. It's at the Rio as well. In this clip, Arterton, who gets more and more responsibility as the film goes on, is telling Bill Nighy how she's going to beef up his character as he's questioning, what am I doing here?
This is from the film Their Finest.
Mr. Elliott, you're right. You're right. Everything you just said. It's about respect for the art and for the artists. And it makes me think,
how wrong we've been playing Uncle Frank for laughs. Yes, he's a drunkard and a clown, but he's also all those people who gave their sons to one war and now their grandsons to another. If we served that truth, if we gave you an Uncle Frank really worth your time and your talent, I wonder if you would consider putting that same time and talent towards helping Mr. Lundbeck and the picture.
All right.
It's a movie about movies, like Beck described The Transfiguration, and I like movies about movies.
Yeah. Okay. So do you, everybody else like it?
I have reservations because there's a love story that doesn't really even need to be there. Mm. But yeah, the part about making movies is great.
Yeah, it's not a wholehearted embrace. No. There, Beck. A little reservation there. Okay. Kind of mixed review for Their Finest. Okay. How about Tommy's Honor, Bob Butler? This is a biopic about golfer Tommy Morris Jr., who to this day remains the youngest major champ in the history of golf.
You know, I don't think that many of the 60 million golfers in the world would even recognize the name of Tommy Morris Jr. or Sr. And this movie, which is from director Jason Connery, Sean Connery's son, by the way.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. It's fascinating look at the way golfing used to be in the mid-19th century. Tommy Sr., played by the ever-great Peter Mullen, he's the groundskeeper, the golf pro. He's everything at the great St. Andrews Links in Scotland, where golf began a century earlier. Mm-hmm. He's also probably the world's best golfer, and back then, a golfer basically golfed and people bet on the side, and there was no purse for the golfer himself. If he was lucky, the people who made money by betting on him gave him some of theirs. Along comes Tommy Jr., his son, who's played here by a really good young actor named Jack Loudon. Tommy Jr. grows up playing golf. He gets better than his dad. He goes out on the links, out on the tournament circuit, if you will, and he demands the money up front, which does not go over well with the high-class swells who have been backing golf up to this point. I'll tell you what I really dearly love about this movie. The acting is fine. The story is true and kind of heartbreaking in the end of the depiction of golf at a time before all the rules and before it all been codified. It's a mob of people moving across the landscape, yelling out bets to each other, throwing fist fights at each other, getting so close to the golfers that they risk getting clubbed in the head. It was a walking riot is what it was. And that I found to be absolutely fascinating.
That's interesting.
It's also about class. As mm-hmm. you said, the guys who ran the pool, tournaments look down on him, and in turn his family, he falls in love with this woman who works as a servant in a house in their town, and his mother has a terrible reaction to that. It's just stratification of class. Yes, it exists in our country, but nothing like that. And mm-hmm. and it still exists in England.
Well, our clip has Tommy Jr. dealing with the rich guys who up to now have been calling the shots, and he's laying down his own law about how it's going to be from now on.
This is from Tommy's Honor.
We've always been very generous with you, Tommy. More so than with your father, as a matter of fact. But then you've always been more valuable to us in some ways.
My view of my value differs from yours, Captain. You see, Davy and I are the ones playing the match, so we should be the ones collecting on the stakes.
That'd be ridiculous.
It's time for a new arrangement, sir.
An arrangement? You are not my business partner. You have your role, and we reward you for it, just as we do with your father and the rest.
If you want me to play in the match tomorrow, then the money comes to me before we begin, all of it. I'll take my fair share, and I'll give the rest back to you. Otherwise, you can find yourself another player.
Your station in life was set before you were born, young Morris. Now, you've done well for yourself, I grant you that. But never think that putting on a gentleman's suit makes you a gentleman.
That's the great Sam Neill playing the aristocrat.
Oh, yeah, right. So y'all like Tommy's Honor?
I liked it.
I did.
I did not.
You did not.
You did not. Beck, you're hard this
I
week.
I am. I have that reputation of being hard on movies.
Yeah.
I just,
what bothered you about it?
The characters don't seem like real people to me. They seem like ideas.
Oh, so, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Very well said. Okay. So Tommy's Honor is out. Sort of mixed reviews on that one, too. Okay. We got about 10 minutes left in the show. Let's keep rolling here. Colossal is our next film. It's when Seoul, South Korea is attacked by a giant lizard, and don't you know that could happen, and a giant robot. A connection is found between that and two troubled adults in upstate New York, and who's going to help me understand, Beck, what this is all about?
I absolutely
She's going to help me understand what it's all
love
about.
Love this movie.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
This is one I can get behind fully.
Giant lizards in Seoul, South Korea.
Exactly. At their best, monsters in movies are metaphors. And
sure.
I think with these giant monsters, I've always had trouble watching them because, again, they seem like concepts. It's always like, you know, man's interference with the natural order or, you know, I mean, it's understandable that they sort of stemmed from Japan after the hydrogen bomb was dropped and, you know, the radiation and things like that. But they still always just seem like such big concepts that you just couldn't sustain my interest anyway.
Right.
I'd get bored on a Saturday afternoon when they would be showing with the two monsters going at each other.
Yeah, right.
In this movie, the monsters represent individual people and sort of their dynamics
like Trump
together.
We're not going.
No, like Anne Hathaway.
It's Anne
Jason
Hathaway
Sudeikis.
As Gloria, who's a disgraced internet journalist. I think she's sort of based on those young women who started writing for Gawker, who kind of just like laid their whole lives out and then were sort of tossed aside by them when they were seen as too narcissistic and too. So she's a party girl, and her very strict boyfriend kicks her out of her apartment, you know, because she's an alcoholic, and she goes back home and stays at the empty house where she grew up, and she reconnects with this childhood friend played by Jason Sudeikis, and they hang out. He has inherited a bar from his dad, and they hang out at the bar and getting drunk, and a lot of it is that she cannot remember what happens after she gets drunk in the night. And she wakes up one morning and she turns on the news and there's this huge monster that is terrorizing Seoul, Korea. And that in itself is sort of funny in how they normalize it. You know, she calls her boyfriend in New York and is like, "Did you see what happened?" And he's like, "You know, that was 9 hours ago. Like, we've moved on, you know?"
Right.
And she even mentioned something about how if it doesn't happen in other places, people are soon going to really lose interest because it's just this one place. And if it doesn't affect you directly anymore, then nobody cares.
Mm-hmm.
She talks about, you know, how, you know, treaties and making it political. But without – you can't go into this with any spoilers because it'll just ruin it. But instead of being like a satire on monster movies, this is actually a take on sort of the drippy romantic drama where the lead goes back to their hometown and rediscovers themselves and what they love and things like that. And it's starting to go that way, but then it switches and it becomes something else entirely.
So when I was seeing it, when I was watching it, I thought, please tell me this is not about this is not a metaphor, which is what you're exactly confirming.
Right.
I said, please tell me this isn't just about the monsters we all have inside of us.
I don't think it's the monsters inside of us. I think it's the dynamics that we have with each other. And her monster is based on the dynamic that she has with this boyfriend who is very controlling. And then the childhood friend and an incident that happened with him. There's an origin story. And
Right.
Yeah.
We can't give away what really happens and what the real connection is about.
Well, this is really interesting because Seoul, South Korea, and robots
is
and lizards
upstate New York?
And
right.
upstate New York.
Yes.
This is just
well, Sudeikis is fine. Hathaway, I usually don't like her, but she's okay.
Well, I think
I
love it because they're such dynamic characters and they have opposite trajectories of how they're changing.
Mm-hmm. So, and what's the clip we got here?
We have a clip, I think, where Sudeikis and Hathaway have had a discovery and they're sort of reconnecting. At first, when she first gets back to town, she relies on him a lot. And there is something there that she doesn't quite trust him, and they have this moment which really connects them. And so they're in this park talking to each other, and I think he's confessing to her, or she's explaining to him what's happened in her life, and he confesses to her that he's been following her all along.
Okay, this is from Colossal.
When they started downsizing, I was the first to go. Oh, you jerk. You already knew.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Why didn't you tell me? Why are you letting me, like...
I didn't want you to think I was creepy, like I'm some sort of stalker.
Oh, well, it's too late for that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you've been following me all these years?
Of course I have. Somebody actually made it out of here and did something special for once. Hell, look what had to happen for things to get interesting around here.
Giants attacking South Korea.
No. I mean you.
Okay, that's from Colossal. All right. Let's go to another one here, T2 Train Spotting. Beck, this is director Danny Boyle's sequel to the 1996 movie about Scotland's drug culture.
Yeah, the original movie in 1996.
We got about a minute and a half here, so we have to go quick.
It was a touchstone, I think, for a whole generation. And so highly anticipated sequel. But it's actually a really great movie in itself, just talking about they're in middle age now and the things, Ewan McGregor had this great Choose Life speech in the original, and he updates it for himself now, where before we were choosing material things, and now we choose Twitter and Instagram and looking up old flames, wishing you'd done it all differently, you know, all this regret. And it's a really good portrayal of him.
That's
in
interesting.
Tell me this, Beck. You didn't see it, Bob, right?
No.
I love Danny Boyle. I love Trainspotting 21 years ago? Why do I have no interest in seeing this? Do you have any idea?
I think there's just this idea that it's just a sequel and we're going to be revisiting the same themes.
Mm-hmm.
You have to think of it as a new movie. It's actually, I think, kind of a disservice to call it Trainspotting 2.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe so. I mean,
I'd love to see another one in 20 years when they're 60 years old.
Okay. Of all the films we talked about here this week, which are on your 3-to-see list, the top recommendations you have going forward, Steve Walker?
Mine are Graduation, the Romanian film, The Transfiguration, about the African-American teenager, and Their Finest.
Their Finest. Okay. Beck?
Colossal, The Transfiguration, and Trainspotting 2.
Okay. Robert?
Well, I can't remember. Seriously, I can't remember. I know I've got Get Out on there, which is still playing. Which still knocks me out. I did definitely have After the Storm. Anybody know what my third one was?
We'll get it.
We'll get to it.
Go to our website. Maybe you can put it up there at kcur.org and figure out what it is. I want to thank Steve Walker, Bob Butler, Beck Ireland for taking some time and coming in some great recommendations and reviews. Sure appreciate it, guys.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.
Okay, find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. On Monday's show, we look at the future of civil discourse with PBS host Alexander Heffner, and we talk to a real live mermaid, and I kid you not, a real live mermaid. That's the music. Our theme music is by the great Bobby Watson. You're listening to it right now. We had help this week from Steven Steigman, Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tadakoro. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.